By sunset, all Weisei was so drunk that it went reeling and bawling about the streets, committing all sorts of nuisances. But in the early morning and forenoon, it was still fresh-eyed and well in hand, receptive to the splendors of Pharaoh's progress when he drove out to receive the office of his father, in the official phrase, and Amun moved in his famous procession on the Nile to Opet, to his southern house of women. The populace was all joyous reverence and pious zeal. Untiringly it gazed upon the unfolding splendors of state and church, which were calculated to lay up in the hearts of Weisei's children and her guests a fresh supply of daily patience and proudly self-deluded devotion to the fatherland. This was accomplished nearly as efficiently in the present as in the old days when earlier kings came home booty-laden and triumphant from Nubian and Asiatic campaigns and perpetuated their victories in reliefs on the great temple walls, victories which had made Egypt great and were indeed the first beginnings of the exploitations and floggings of the little peasants. On high feast days, Pharaoh drove out wearing crown and gloves. He came out from his palace, brilliant like the rising sun, and betook himself to his father's house to behold his beauty, in his high, swaying, canopied carrying chair, surrounded by ostrich feather fans, enveloped in heavy clouds of fragrant smoke, which streamed back upon him from incense bearers walking in front of his chair, their faces turned toward the good God. The voices of the reading priests were drowned in the jubilations of the throng, as they hopped on one leg and rejoiced. Drums and cornets preceded the procession, in which walked troops of Pharaoh's relations, dignitaries, unique and true friends of the king, as well as just plain friends. Ranks of soldiers closed up the rear with field badges, battle axes, and throw sticks. The lifetime of Re to thee, the peace of Amun. But where should one stand, staring, swallowing dust, stretching one's neck? Were it better here, or at Karnak, beside Amun's house, aflutter with banners, whither everything would finally proceed? For the god himself came out today, left the dim shrine in the farthest background of his mammoth tomb, behind all the forecourts, courts, and halls, each one lower-ceilinged and more silent than the last, and moved, a strange, misshapen, squatting puppet, through all his halls, each loftier and more brilliantly colored, on his bark, adorned with the heads of rams, secluded in his veil-shrouded chapel, which was borne by long poles on the shoulders of 24 shiny pates in starched kilts. He, too, among fans, in clouds of incense, went into the light and the noise to meet his son. The great event was the flight of geese, a custom dating from primitive times, the scene of which was the beautiful meeting place on the square before the temple. What a lovely and joyous spot this was! Gay flags fluttered from gilded poles with the head ornament of the god on top. Mountains of flowers and fruits heaped the offertory tables before the shrine of the holy triad, father, mother, and son. Statues of Pharaoh's ancestors, the kings of Upper and Lower Egypt, brought up by the crew of the sun bark, divided into four watches, were here set up. Priests standing on golden pedestals above the crowd, their faces turned to the four quarters of the earth, released the wild fowl in four directions, to carry to the gods of each the news that Horus, son of Osiris and Eset, had set upon his head the white as well as the red crown. For he that was conceived in death had once chosen this form when he mounted the throne of the two lands, and the ceremony had been repeated through countless years, and lay and learned, in their different ways, had drawn conclusions about the general or the individual destiny from the manner of flight. After the flight of geese, Pharaoh performed many beautiful mysteries and ceremonies on the square. He sacrificed before the images of the early kings. He cut with a golden sickle the sheaf of spelt handed him by a priest, and laid the grain as an offering of praise and petition before his father. He burned the incense of the gods before him in a long-legged pan, while readers and choir-singers chanted out of their book rolls. Then the majesty of this god seated itself in a chair, and sat motionless to receive the congratulations of the court, expressed in quaint and high-sounding words, or brought before him in the shape of letters, couched in flowery, subtilizing phrases from courtiers who were prevented from coming. They were read aloud, to the great entertainment of all who listened. This was only the first act of the celebration, which went on from beauty to beauty. They went down to the Nile, the barks of the holy triad swaying aloft on the shoulders of 24 shiny pates each, and Pharaoh walked, like a modest son, on foot behind his father Amun's bark. The whole crowd swarmed down to the river, thronging round the procession of the gods, led by Bechnekens, the head priest, in his leopard skin, just behind the trumpets and cornets. The incense rose, the music swelled, the fan-bearers fanned. Arrived at the shore, the sacred barks were put on three large ships, each more beautiful than the other, but the most indescribably beautiful of all was Amun's bark, made of cedar wood, which, it was said, the princes of the Retainu had had to fell in the cedar mountains and themselves pole across the river. Each ship was mounted in silver, and all of gold was the great heaven throne in the center, and the flagpoles and obelisks in front, adorned with serpent crowns fore and aft, and furnished with all sorts of little emblematic soul figures and sacred symbols, most of which people would not have known how to explain from so remote a past had they been handed down. The fact strengthened instead of weakening the veneration they enjoyed. The state ships conveying the great triad were not boats, but barges, not rowed, but towed by light galleys and a crew from the shore up the Nile toward the southern house of women. It was an honor to belong to these crews, and a man so chosen reaped many practical benefits throughout the year. All waysay, save the dying and the age-ridden, for the infants were carried on their mothers' backs or at their breasts, in other words, a mighty host rolled like a wave along the bank with the crews, accompanying the divine procession, and a procession in themselves. They were led by a servant of Amun, chanting hymns. Soldiers of the god followed with shields and throw-sticks. Dressed-up negroes came after, greeted with roars of laughter from the crowd as they danced and drummed, cut grimaces, and made ribald jokes. They knew they were held in contempt, and so played the fool even more than lay in their natures, to flatter the grotesque conception the people had of them. Temple musicians of both sexes shook castanets and sistra. There were animals garlanded for the sacrifice, standard-bearers, war chariots, lute-players, upper priests with their retinues. Burghers and peasants followed on, singing and clapping out the time with their hands. Rejoicing and exulting, the train moved on to the pillared temple on the river, where the state ships tied up. The sacred barks were hoisted to the shoulders of the bearers and carried in a new procession, to the sound of drums and long trumpets, to the glorious house of birth, received and met with curtsyings and contortings and waving of boughs by Amun's earthly concubines, the ladies of the Order of Hathor, who now danced before their exalted spouse, the squatting, swaddled little doll in his shrouded bark, in diaphanous garments, beating tambourines, and singing in their universally beloved voices. This was the great New Year's reception in Amun's harem, a most regal spread, mountains of offerings in the shape of food and drink, unending genuflections and symbolic ceremonies, for the most part no longer understood by anybody, in the inmost, inner, and outer parts of the house of embrace and birth, in its rooms full of gay reliefs and inscriptions, its corridors of rose-granite papyrus columns, silver-paved tent halls, and courts of statuary where the populace might enter at will. The full gorgeousness of the new year will be best appreciated if we realize that toward the end of the day, the whole procession reformed in the same splendor as before, and went back by water and land to Karnak, and that in all the temples, the fairs and feastings, the popular jollification and theatrical entertainments, in which masked priests performed scenes from the lives of the gods, went on without stopping through the evening. The whole great city swam in beer and bliss and belief in a carefree golden age. The crews which had towed the state barks, crowned with garlands, anointed with oil, and very drunk indeed, ranged through the streets and might do more or less what they liked without let or hindrance. The Empty House. It was necessary to sketch in the scene of the Feast of Opet, the official celebration of the rising of the Nile, in order to make clear to my readers the frame and setting of those events in the lives of individuals which form the climax of our tale. The bare sketch suffices to show that Petitpré, the courtier, had his time very much taken up. He was a member of the immediate entourage of His Majesty Whore in the Palace, who had this day more pontifical duties to perform than on any other of the high days and holy days in the year. And Petitpré's place was among the nearest, that is, among the unique friends of the king. Yes, on this very morning he was raised to the rare and exalted rank, and addressed in a manner which caused him the utmost gratification. The titular captain of the guard was away from home all day. Indeed, the whole household was away. The place was empty, like every other house in Weisei, for, as I said, only cripples and the moribund remained at home. Among the last, indeed, were Huia and Tuia, the exalted parents in the upper story, for they never went farther afield than the garden house on the mound, and seldom even as far as that. It was a miracle that they yet lived, for during the last 10 years they had reckoned hourly on their passing, yet still tottered about, the old mole and the swamp beaver, she with her blind slits of eyes, he with his beard of tarnished silver, together within the dark call of their brother-sisterhood, perhaps because some aged people simply go on living and cannot find death, being powerless to die, perhaps because they were afraid of the king of the nether regions and the 40 frightfully named ones on account of the clumsy bribery of which they had once been guilty. Huia and Tuia, then, had remained at home in their upper story, together with the 2 stupid little maids who served them in succession to others grown in the course of time too unchildlike to wait on the exalted parents. Otherwise, house and court were empty, like all others in Weisei. Yet were they? No, for there was one other exception, single but important. Mut M. Innet, Potiphar's wife, his chief and first, had stopped at home. That must seem very strange to anyone with knowledge of the feast. She did not take part with her sisterhood, Amun's concubines, in the sacred service of the god, did not wear the horns and disk, nor in the narrow garment of Hathor undulate in the dance, nor raised her beloved voice to accompaniment of the silver rattle. She had made her excuses to the protectress of the order, Ti, wife of the god. They were the same excuses which Rachel had once made a pretext what time she sat on the teraphim hidden in the camel bedding, and would not rise and stand before Laban. She had sent word that unfortunately she was unwell, meaning, by the discreet phrase, that unfortunately on this very day she found herself incapacitated. The exalted ladies had shown more understanding than Petitpré, to whom she had said the same. For he, with a lack of feeling for human frailty, had been as obtuse as in his time the obtuse Laban. "How do you mean, unwell?" he asked. "Have you a toothache? Or the vapors?" He used a silly medical expression current in high society to describe a hypochondriac state of health. And when she had finally gone into detail, he had been unwilling to admit the excuse. "That doesn't count," he had said. Very much, we will remember, as Laban in his time had done. "That is not an illness that anyone can see, or an excuse for staying away from the feast of the god. Some people would drag themselves to it half-dead rather than stay away, but you want to remain at home on account of a simple and normal thing like that." "There does not need to be anything unnatural about an ailment for it to attack us, my friend," she answered him. Then she gave him the choice of dispensing her either for the public feast or for the private entertainment at their own home in the evening, with which Petitpré was to celebrate his promotion to the rank of unique friend. It was impossible, she said, for her to attend at both. If she danced before the god, she would be worn out by evening and have to absent herself from Petitpré's feast. In the end, though in great annoyance, he had had to agree to her saving her strength in the daytime in order to act as hostess in the evening. He was annoyed because he was suspicious. So much we can say with certainty. He did not like it. He did not feel easy in his mind at her remaining at home alone on the pretext that she was unwell. He was disturbed. He had a vague sense of apprehension, on the score of his own peace of mind and that of the household. And he came home earlier than necessary to the evening party, on his lips the usual question, outwardly confident but inwardly anxious, "Is all well in the house? Is the mistress happy? This time to receive a frightful but secretly long-expected reply.